This is an ABC podcast.
Ferocious and cute. An excellent combination for Off Track with me, Anne Jones.
How many have we got? Is that three babies?
Oh my God, that's insane.
The Eastern Quoll is a small cat-sized marsupial with big white spots and long whiskers, and it used to be found on mainland Australia, roaming the woodlands as a top-order predator. But due to habitat loss and disease and competition with foxes, these once plentiful little native cats, apparently so plentiful that they were pests who would kill your backyard chickens, they've all disappeared from the mainland, though they remained relatively strong on the island state of Tasmania. Fast forward to today, the Eastern Quoll is in just three locations on the mainland, apart from in traditional zoos and breeding programs. All of those three are reintroduction sites, and one of them is this place, Mulligan's Flat Woodland Sanctuary in the Australian Capital Territory.
Mulligan's Flat is a fenced-off nature reserve in the ACT.
Dr. Kate Grarock was the ecologist at Mulligan's Flat up until recently. She was still, when I was there recording this story, in spring last year.
It's just like many of our other nature reserves in Canberra, but the thing that I guess makes it really special is our fence. It keeps foxes and cats out. It's also really special because it's box gum grassy woodland, which is a critically endangered ecosystem. The fence went up in 2012, so we have been doing sort of research before that time. So we sort of look at Mulligan's as a massive outdoor laboratory where we're doing sort of different, I guess, manipulations and looking at, oh, what happens if we add fallen timber? Oh, wow, the beetle diversity goes through the roof, and sort of learning like that. So it is very new.
It has to be one of the biggest open-air laboratories in the world. How big is the enclosed area?
Yeah, so we've got 485 hectares in the old sanctuary, I guess the Mulligan's proper. When I looked at it, it's the size of North Sydney, so the whole suburb of North Sydney. Our fence is 11 kilometres long for the old sanctuaries, and we've just really excited to say that we've extended the sanctuary and almost tripled it in size. So that means more betongs, more quolls, more experiments, more learning about how to make woodlands healthy, thriving ecosystems. You know, our sanctuary is open to the public. That's part of what we're trying to do here, is like show people how amazing woodlands can be and how thriving they can be with little critters bouncing along the forest floor. We've got some very early joggers and runners groups that come through with headlamps some mornings. The birds always, you know, get pretty rowdy once the first light comes through. Then I guess, yeah, the birds continue to do their thing. The choughs are out and about. Then I guess we've got the human element. We have our researchers coming in. We have, you know, Woodlands and Wetlands Trust researchers, ACT government researchers, Australian National University researchers doing a whole range of activities.
Or Tim, or someone who isn't about to grab a call. Yep. Could you run down and grab cable ties out of the car? They're in their radio.
The sun's just set now and we've got this spotlight and we're going to go for a little walk through the woodland and see if we can find some of these amazing nocturnal animals. So I guess the main things we'll be looking for are quolls, obviously. It's always nice to see a quoll. We've got eastern betongs, which are just mini kangaroos. Bushstone curlews we quite regularly hear. Oh, there's a betong. See behind that stump? Near with the tussocks.
Oh, my God.
Just sneak towards him. They're bloody fast. So they use these tussocks for nesting. So they have what's called a semi-prehensile tail, and they'll collect nesting material in their tail and then go into a grassy tussock and make like a little bird-shaped nest. So that one's probably just come out of the tussock there. We'll sneak a little closer. Oh, there he goes!
Oh, he's so quick!
His legs are so skinny, he just looks like he's hovering.
I know, right? And their little T-Rex arms. It's pretty cool.
Wow.
Do you see that on the tree? It's
up.
A sugar glider.
On the other side.
Oh, he's sneaking away. Let's go get him.
Something over there. It could just be a spider. just like the forest is alive at night, and it's so exciting to see. I think not enough Australians get out in the forest at night or the woodlands at night and see that and hear those critters that are everywhere, you know, the crunches, the squeaks, the, you know, the running across the forest floor and finding insects that little quolls are doing, or the bettongs digging at the bottom of your wattle tree and trying to get some sap. So it really is just a hive of activity 24/7 out here in the sanctuary, whether it be people or animals.
And tonight, these humans are out in the predator-proof sanctuary to search for some V.I. squeeze. That's very important, quolls. It's the middle of the night, and PhD student Belinda Wilson and a team of her helpers are ready to trap.
So the eastern quoll is their common name, but yeah, back in the day in the 1800s when they didn't have that name, they were called the native cat. It kind of looks a little bit like a smaller version of a cat, but with a bit more of a slender body. It comes in actually two different colour morphs. So we've got a sandy fawn kind of colour and still with white spots. And then they also come in the second colour, which is jet black with white spots, which is really quite spectacular. I've got a soft spot for them. And I kind of like to liken them to the cheetahs and the tigers that we have elsewhere in the world. And it seems to be something quite unique to the predators, to the carnivores, and it helps to blur out their silhouette so that when they're hunting something, they can't be seen as well by their prey.
Predator or not, the first glimpse of not just a quoll, but a baby quoll, literally the size of a tiny little kitten, is enough to make this radio person and all of those scientists go a little bit gaga.
Oh, oh my God.
You are so cute.
That's insane.
Unlike the cats, they actually hold things with their paws. So they're dexterous.
Oh, dang it. It's like a pile of cute kitties. Yeah.
What sort of role is it believed that quolls play in an ecosystem?
Yeah, so I guess they're sort of a top order predator. I mean, the Book of Australian Mammals has this imagery that they talk about as like they dance light-footed over the forest floor at night listening for insects. And so you can just imagine their little ears twitching left and right and listening for that, you know, that centipede or something under the forest floor, and then pouncing on it and digging up that tasty little morsel. And I mean, just to see them doing that would be, you know, so special.
And this place, Mulligan's Flat, is one of the only places you might see that, because a couple of years back, eastern quolls were released into the predator-proof enclosure right here. Dr. Kate was there on the first release night.
He jumped into the air and like sprang off and just shot off down the path, and everyone's sort of, woo, you know, like silly humans. We actually got an Aboriginal man to release one of the quolls, which was pretty special because they are quite important to the local Ngunnawal people. Then the tracking began. Every day we're out there tracking them, making sure they're doing well. I like to describe it, it's like trying to keep a mouse in a football stadium. So it's a massive area, they're a small little animal, and any small, say, little gap or, you know, weakness they might find and then exit the sanctuary, because they're just trying to find a great place to set up, and they don't realise that there is a danger outside that fence. And so there were, you know, a couple of quolls that got out, and I remember one day I was tracking one into New South Wales, walking about 12 k's over the hill, must just be over this one, oh no, and then over the next hill, and then over the next hill, and then, yep, finally found him. And we got the crew in and we put sort of like little, I don't know, like a, almost like a bird netting over this rabbit warren that he'd found himself in. And then we like slowly dug him out and boom, he came out at a million miles an hour, and we caught him and put him in a bag. And I think we had like a two strike, you're out sort of rule. So, you know, if you escape twice, you're off to the breeding, you know, back at Mount Rothwell, and then, you know, we can use the genetics there. But unfortunately it is a very, very dangerous over the fence for them. So we had to be right on top of that and catch them as soon as we could.
Because just over the fence there's cats and foxes, but there's also dogs and cars.
Cars, yeah, dogs, cars, all the bad things for poor little quolls. So, but we sort of found, I think, basically after 2 weeks, they really settle down once they're sort of, we can keep them in for about 2 weeks in the sanctuary. You know, it's just that initial period. You think about yourself, you know, if you grab you and drop you in a new environment, you're going to sort of be looking around and where's a safe place to live? Oh, yep, okay, this is a really good hole. I can live here safely. There's food about, boom, and then they settle down and start to do their thing. I think Belinda's done some work on temperament too. So it's like, is it good to have a bold, like, adventurous quoll, or is it good to have, like, just a chillax quoll that will just stay there? We did actually have a female quoll we called, like, the Ginger Ninja, and she was a tricksy little one. We had to go catch her, I think, twice. She got the two-strike rule, and she munched her way through one of the ranger's hands. she was amazing, but we ended up sending her to the breeding site because her genetics were so important.
Hello.
And they're feisty, no matter the age. Here's Belinda Wilson with a tiny quoll in her hand.
Okay, so for this one, I think it might be easier if we just... Oh, you're biting.
Belinda Wilson is writing a PhD all about these quolls at Mulligan's Flat.
And can't look at your finger.
Ooh, he really did give it a whirl, didn't he?
Yeah, it just proves how, as a carnivore, they really need that jaw strength to take down, well, in their case, insects, but also small mammals and reptiles.
So 18 months into your PhD, how many times have you been bitten by quolls so far?
One, two, this will be the third.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's actually really good.
That's one every 6 months. That's not bad. The risk assessment will be okay on that.
So what I wanted to figure out at the very beginning was... Well, before anything else was, how do I catch a quoll? Turns out the winner chicken dinner was sardines. So they go nuts for it. And after I figured out how to capture them, I started to monitor the population that we had, that had been brought in as of 2016. And the next step after, starting and going into a second reintroduction was figuring out how to maximise our survival. So in the first year, we ended up with about 50% surviving, and the majority of those that escaped the sanctuary or suffered misadventure, turns out that they were the big beefy males. So we thought, right, there's some trend going on here. So in my first decision coming into the Mulligan's Flat Gariru project was to bring in females only, and to bring them in at a different kind time of year, which meant that instead of bringing them in pre-breeding, when all their hormones are driving them crazy and perhaps driving them over the fence, I actually thought that if we brought them in post-breeding and with the females already bearing pouch young, we could do a double whammy and have them a bit calmer, as well as bringing in genetics from those fathers from Tasmania.
Are there some different risks involved in that strategy, i.e. transporting females in a gravid state?
Yeah, and those are all things that we considered when we brought them in. Turns out that our fears were unfounded because they held up like champs, and then we ended up with well over 40 Tasmanian descendants running around the sanctuary in 2017. So after, hitting that over 90% survival rate, you can't get much better than that for reintroductions. We were blown away.
And now, it's past 2:30 a.m. and the quoll team are still monitoring the health and the weight of the most recent batch of babies. Transported here in 2018, latched onto their mothers, some of these young quolls will be taken to the breeding program at Mount Rothwell in Victoria, and all will be monitored for their health and well-being.
And the idea is that if we take a certain subset of those juveniles over to our sister sanctuary, Mount Rothwell, we'll be able to make sure that their insurance population has just the right amount of genetics that we have. That's not represented in any other population on the mainland or elsewhere. So that's really exciting. And in that way, it means that someday we'll be able to fuel a beyond-the-fence reintroduction with a really healthy, genetically diverse, self-sustaining population.
Still awake?
Yeah,
in truth, I'm only just still awake. Actually, at this point, I don't even know what time it is, but we're at Mulligan's Flat Woodland Sanctuary in the ACT, and you're listening to ABC's Off Track. We're checking traps for baby quolls.
Oh, dark mole! Is that three babies?
This night, for these young quolls, is momentous. This is where they'll be leaving their mum's home for good.
So the eastern quolls, they're actually really solitary hunters. At the very beginning of their lives, they hang out with their siblings and they play tussle and all of that. But as of the time that they leave the natal den, then it's sayonara. They never see each other again unless it comes to looking around for mates, and then they'll try and meet up. So that would be around the March, April, May sort of time of the year, so austral autumn. And yeah, around that time, this is the only period where the males will start to co-den with the females. Otherwise, males are completely solitary. On the other hand, females I have noticed actually co-den quite a lot during the winter, and that's perhaps to keep each other warm and cuddle up underground.
So why do you think a male will co-den with a female in the lead up to a mating event?
Ah, perhaps trying to just get her on side, cuddle up to her, make sure that it's true love. yeah.
Would it be about trying to protect his genetic line?
Yeah, possibly, but there is always that potential that the female in amongst her foraging might mate with another male. So he could try as he might, but they are a promiscuous species.
What happens then? What is gestation like for a quoll?
So once a mummy and daddy quoll love each other very much and they end up conceiving some young, after 20 days, the mother will give birth and she'll lick a little bit of a line up from her tracts to her pouch, and then these tiny little pink, blind and hairless little pouch young will start to climb out. And she can keep giving birth for quite some time, and at the end it can be up to 30 of these tiny little babies about the size of a grain of rice. I've caught a female that was in the middle of giving birth, and there were little ones climbing out of the tract. That was quite a sight. So to see them unlatched, I don't know if many people ever would have seen that sort of thing.
What did they look like?
They honestly looked like really small, stumpy bloodworms. So all veiny and pink, and their legs they were just kind of dragging behind them, but the real strength is in their forearms, and they're really quite well defined. And then you can see the black patches of the eyes that are, of course, not able to glean any sort of sight, so they use entirely their sense of smell to get to the pouch.
That is incredible that you witnessed that. What was the mother, was she paying attention to what was happening, you know, with the crawl of the young?
Yeah, she was fully aware, and also not entirely happy that we had caught her at this stage. So we very quickly put her back into her den so she could have the peace and quiet she needed to give birth. And each mother can give birth to up to 30 little pink, blind and hairless little babies. But when they make their way up from the tract to the teat, they will actually find only 6 teats. So from the very beginning, it is survival of the fittest. And they'll actually latch onto there for quite some time, but any remaining ones, I like to call it recycling. The mother will often eat them up to save energy.
So that latch, is it like a I'm here for the next month and I'm not moving from this teat latch?
Yeah, exactly. So they'll bite down with their newly formed teeth, and the skin of their jaw will actually fuse to the teat itself. So they cannot be taken off, and they'll stay that way for several months until they're starting to fur, and then slowly they'll unfuse and their lips will form and then they can let go.
That's like some alien crap right there.
It is.
That's amazing.
So when they finally start to unfuse, they're just starting to get the beginnings of their fur. So they're kind of like, a day growth on a man's chin. At this stage, because you're starting to see the fur, therefore you start to see the spots for the very first time. Once the young ones are unfusing, she's then able to deposit them. So that's the age of deposition. And this happens at about the 4-month mark. She'll put them in the natal den, and then for the first time in a few months, she's able to run free without them hanging on to her for dear life. And their pouches, they're quite a bit less springy than you would expect from, say, a kangaroo. So the pouch young don't actually fit in the pouch. They will be hanging on to the teat and just dragged along the ground because she's so small. And then after that stage comes the stage of emergence, which is about where we are right now. So that's when they're fully furred, they've been given lots of milk, mum's raised them up nice and healthy, and they start to take their first few steps out into the sun.
The sun. But should they be out in the sun?
So I'm noticing that the babies don't seem to care as much about daytime versus nighttime, which is much to the annoyance of mum, who will often come out of the den even though she's meant to be sleeping and watch over them as they explore. We've had quite a few of our litters who come out just in the middle of the day, just exploring, and then likewise they'll come out at night. So it's much like a human in that their sleep cycles are just shortened and the mum just kind of has to deal with it.
Sounds so tiring. So we're getting to the point now then where we've got teenage quolls. What are they like?
At about this stage, they're well and truly feeling confident in themselves and running around on the ground and bowling over their siblings and also a bit of play fighting. So now that they're coming into their big boy teeth, they're really starting to try and learn how to hunt, and that comes from trying it on your siblings. So the next stage is leaving mum for the very last time, and then they become those solitary hunters. And at this stage, they're so small, you wouldn't believe they'd be able to hunt anything on their own, but they can and they will, and they'll grow very rapidly once they start taking full meat meals.
So tonight, in the crisp, deep blue air, the teenage quolls are edged out of metal traps by blowing on them. See, they find that sound a little bit threatening and they move away from it.
You ready to grab the bag?
Yeah.
And then they're held in a small cotton bag.
Hold tail, base of the tail. Okay, and that gives me a nice...
So tiny. And measured.
8D4D, female fawn.
A fur sample is taken for DNA and wrapped in foil. And a microchip is inserted.
Three, two, one.
3C84.
Yep.
All of this so the individual and their genetics can be tracked.
Britt, in the notes section for these guys, write presumed offspring of 47.
Then, a group of individuals, not all of the babies born at the sanctuary this year.
Right, so is that baby done?
Yep.
But some of them are selected to take to Victoria to join the breeding program.
Yep. We have a boy.
Mercury.
Who is fawn.
Not before they get names, though.
We have a boy who is black.
Oh!
He did turn out to be Moss.
He's anyway. Moss.
Yeah.
What is that? Moss?
Moss, as in from IT crowd.
Okay. A888.
Yeah. That's so nice.
I've already done those. Yeah.
Belinda Wilson is writing a PhD at the Australian National University, and she continues working with these quolls.
The overall aim that we want is to have eastern quolls back on the mainland in the large numbers that we used to have them. So that's the end game. So that's really exciting. In terms of what makes mulligans amazing, it's part of the biggest unfragmented patch of boxgum grassy woodlands in Australia and therefore the world. And so it's optimum habitat for the grassy and woodland loving eastern quoll. So there's no better place for it to have come back.
Dr. Kate Grarock is a superstar of STEM and has just moved on from her ecologist job at Mulligan's Flat Sanctuary.
Yeah, it's just so precious to
be, you know, actually to be working on a positive environmental project is really, really special because, you know, a lot of my friends, unfortunately, that we did environmental science together, they're working on projects, you know, they're doing environmental impact statements and then they're developing a road or a mine, and to actually be doing good for the environment is quite rare and really special.
All right, so Merino is...
And with time, these little quolls will become big quolls, parents themselves, and contribute to the rewilding of Australia.
D378.
Yep. I'm Anne Jones, and this is Off Track. Subscribe to the podcast if you'd like, and find me on social media. And also, take care of yourself. Until next time, because that's when I'll take you somewhere else.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.